The Oracle Network.
Hi. Welcome to The Jury Room, a true crime podcast. My name is Kevin, and I will be your host on this journey. We will be covering some of the most heinous, some of the most unthinkable, and some of the most monstrous crimes to ever be committed against humanity. We will be covering cannibalistic serial killers, decades-old unsolved mysteries, cold cases, missing person cases, and everything in between. The Jury Room podcast is available on most major podcasting platforms. Please make sure you go subscribe and leave a review.
Hello, and welcome back to True Crime Cat Lawyer. I'm your host, Elise, joined by my co-host, Winston the Cat. Every other week, Winston and I will bring you a new story about a murder, disappearance, or serial killer, with a special focus on cases from our hometown, the Pacific Northwest. Just a reminder, this podcast contains content of a graphic nature that might not be suitable for all listeners, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, and crimes against animals and children. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to True Crime Cat Lawyer. For the month of September, Winston and I decided that we were going to do a series on missing persons, and today's episode is going to focus on missing kids from the Pacific Northwest. We have six stories to tell you. Some are longer than others just because of how much coverage the cases got in the media, but all the cases we've covered and will cover in the future are incredibly important. So let's get started. Michael Wayne Dunahy was born on May 12, 1986. He was from Victoria, British Columbia, and I'm going to jump right into his disappearance because there's not a lot of information about his background, unfortunately. So on March 24, 1991, Michael was at his mother's football practice with both his mom and his dad. His mother was in a women's football league. Michael asked his mom if he could play in the park located at Blanchard Elementary School while she played football. His mother, Crystal, told him to stay in the park and wait for his dad to come get him. So he's at the park, his mom's playing football. His dad goes to find him, and this is around 12 p.m., Bruce, Michael's dad, goes to look for him. He doesn't see him, can't find him anywhere, and so he immediately calls 911. Bruce, Crystal, the football players, and the neighbors around the Blanchard Elementary School immediately began looking for Michael, but there was no sign of him. This was one of the largest missing persons cases ever investigated in Canadian history, and it was quickly classified as an abduction because of how quick everything happened. Police eventually staged a reenactment of Michael's disappearance, but that reenactment failed to generate any new leads. They had over 12,000 tips and 789 possible sightings of Michael, but none of them panned out. Bruce and Crystal, the football players, neighbors in the area, and known sex offenders in the area were all cleared. One witness reported seeing a brown van near the playground, but either police never found that van or nothing ever came from that tip. In 2009, police found a missing poster of Michael in the home of 62-year-old Vernon Seitz, who lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Seitz confessed to his psychiatrist that he murdered a child when he was just 12 years old in 1959. It's unclear if he had any actual connection to Michael, but unfortunately, police couldn't investigate further because he was later found dead from natural causes. Crystal eventually became an advocate for missing children's issues in British Columbia. She even served as the president of Child Find British Columbia. And in 2002, she advocated for the RCMP to utilize the Amber Alert system, which had not been previously used. And unfortunately, that is where this case stands today. There have been no updates, no sightings, no further information on what happened to Michael Dennehy after March 1991, when he disappeared from that park. And I'll link the Victoria Police tip information in our show notes if you have any information that you would like to provide to the RCMP. The next case I'm going to cover is Joanne Peterson. At the time of her disappearance, Joanne was 10 years old. She was born in 1972, and unfortunately, like Michael's case, I don't have any real background on Joanne. On the day of her disappearance, February 19th, 1983, Joanne was walking home from the mall with her sister and her 14-year-old cousin. Her mother and her stepfather were at a nearby Legion Hall, and Joanne's sister and cousin locked Joanne out of the house as a prank. Joanne got upset, and it was cold and raining outside, so she decided to go to the Penny Pincher convenience store to call her parents. So she didn't realize after she left that her sister eventually opened the door, but Joanne wasn't there. So Joanne went to the Penny Pincher, and she used a payphone to dial the operator for the number of the Legion Hall to get a hold of her mom and stepdad. She got in touch with her stepdad, and he said he was going to come pick her up. 30 minutes later, her stepdad got to the payphone, but Joanne was gone. Some witnesses described seeing Joanne with an adult man in the phone booth. He was described as Caucasian, approximately 20 to 30 years old, 5'6 to 5'7, with a slim to medium build, light to dark hair, and clean shaven. Like in Michael's case, the Chilliwack RCMP did a reenactment of the incident, but again, no further leads were generated from this reenactment. The Chilliwack Progress posted a $1,000 reward for further information, but again, that reward has never been collected. In 2011, an anonymous letter was sent to the Chilliwack RCMP about Joanne's disappearance. It generated a lot of tips, but again, nothing came from it, though police do believe the author of that letter witnessed the events leading up to Joanne's disappearance. But because it was anonymous, they haven't been able to track that person down. If you have any information on the disappearance of Joanne Peterson, please call the Chilliwack RCMP at 1-604-792-4611 or the Canada Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477. Our next story takes us to Oregon. Casey Perry was born on May 31st, 1980. She lived in Kaiser with her mom, Tammy Perry, as her parents were never married and her mother had legal custody of her. On the day she disappeared, September 14th, 1990, Casey was visiting her dad in Southeast Portland. Casey and her dad had spent the day shopping and had dinner together before Casey went to bed around 10. Now, I did read that Casey and her dad got into an argument before she went to bed because Casey's dad wanted Casey to move in with him and his wife because he was troubled by the conditions at Casey's mom's house. This whole conversation really upset Casey, so she decided to go to bed around 10. Her father went in to check on her around 11, but she was gone. So he immediately started searching the house. He started looking around the neighborhood. He drove around the block looking for her. There was no sign of Casey, so he called police and reported her missing. Search dogs were able to track Casey to Laurelhurst Park, but the trail ended there. Other witnesses saw Casey at Kino's food store, which was about 10 blocks away from her dad's house. She had taken a purse with clothes in it, and police found that purse abandoned along with the clothes near that store. Again, there was no sign of Casey. There were unconfirmed sightings of Casey in Albany, Oregon, and Wilsonville, Oregon, but police weren't able to confirm whether that was in fact Casey. The theory was that Casey ran away from her dad's house and was trying to get back to her mom's house in Kaiser. Police do believe that Casey left on her own because there was no sign of a break-in and she had had that argument with her father. According to the Vanished podcast, Casey may have been picked up at the store, but it's unclear if she was picked up by someone she knew or if she was picked up by a stranger. In August of 1991, Brian Keith George confessed to Casey's murder. He was a former boyfriend of Tammy, Casey's mom, but he remained close to Casey and her brother after her mother and him broke up. When he confessed, he was actually in police custody in Portland on a bank robbery charge. He told police he buried Casey's remains in a wooded area near Kelso, Washington. Police searched this area, but they only found animal bones. He has since recanted his confession, but police still consider him a suspect. And this man does have a prior manslaughter conviction for which he served 9 years in prison. After George recanted his statement, he also told police that he believed Casey's father had something to do with her disappearance. But police have come out and said that there's absolutely no evidence to support his allegations. Unfortunately, there have been no official suspects other than George, and despite being profiled on America's Most Wanted, this case remains unsolved, though foul play is suspected. If you have any information on Casey Perry's disappearance, please call the Cold Case Homicide Unit at 503-823-0400. On January 23, 1999, 2-year-old Tika Lewis went bowling with her family at New Frontiers, a bowling alley in Tacoma. Tika wanted to play in the arcade while her family went bowling, so her mother took her and they sort of walked around this arcade. At around 10:15 p.m., Tika sat down in a racing game, pretending to drive the car, and Teresa told her to stay put while she checked on her other kids. When Teresa turned back around, Tika was gone. Teresa started looking all over the bowling alley for Tika. She thought she might be playing hide and seek. She searched the women's restroom, but she didn't find her. At this point, she was starting to panic, so she went outside, she looked in the parking lot, she searched for any sign of Tika around the bowling alley. Teresa eventually found an off-duty officer who helped her with her search. The manager announced that Tika was missing over the loudspeaker in the bowling alley, but it's unlikely anyone heard that announcement because it was so loud in there. After Teresa and the off-duty officer couldn't find any sign of Tika, they called the Tacoma Police Department. They searched the bowling alley and a heavily wooded area, as well as a residential neighborhood adjacent to the bowling alley. Because of Tika's age and the circumstances around her disappearance, the FBI and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, or NCMEC, immediately joined the search. They were running two parallel investigations. They were investigating the case as a possible familial abduction, as well as a possible stranger abduction. Tika's mom described her as shy and a mama's girl. She said it was unlikely that Tika would have gone off willingly with a stranger. Teresa cooperated fully with the investigation, and she voluntarily submitted to two polygraphs. Police deemed her to be truthful, and she was cleared as a suspect. As for Tika's father, he was in prison on a 4-year sentence for theft. He had an ironclad alibi, so he was also ruled out as a suspect. Police interviewed 300 witnesses from the bowling alley. One witness described seeing a speeding Grand Am leaving the parking lot, and another witness thought he saw a man following Tika around the arcade, but he couldn't be sure, and he kind of assumed it was her dad. But he did give police a description of the man. The description he provided was that the man was a male Caucasian, 5'11", with a husky build, shoulder-length curly brown hair, a thick mustache, and a, quote, heavily pockmarked face, end quote. Witnesses described the Grand Am as a 1990s maroon or purple car with a spoiler on the back. Again, this car was seen speeding out of the bowling alley parking lot when Tika went missing. In 2006, Teresa hired a private investigator. This private investigator found a girl in Texas who they thought might be Tika, but unfortunately, a DNA test proved that it wasn't Tika. In 2008, cold case detectives were assigned to the case. They released home video of Tika that had never been seen before. In January 2012, cold case detectives looked at attempted abductions in the area. They found out that on November 29, 1998, a 4-year-old boy had been sexually assaulted in the bathroom of a bowling alley by a man with curly brown hair and a beard. They also found that a few weeks before Tika went missing, there was another attempted abduction of a 6-year-old boy at the bowling alley. Unfortunately, police weren't called by the bowling alley staff on either occasion. Both of these boys were playing in the arcade prior to the incidences. Police really focused in on these two cases as being possibly related because there was a consistent suspect description provided. In July 2012, police searched the home of John Black, who lived in Tacoma. He had pled guilty to child luring at a bowling alley in 2010. Cadaver dogs alerted to something in his backyard, but nothing was ever found. He denied any involvement in Tika's disappearance, and he was eventually cleared as a suspect. Detectives have had over 700 tips since Tika went missing. They believe that the suspect seen by the teen, the man with the curly brown hair and the heavily pockmarked face, is the man responsible for abducting Tika. At the time of the disappearance in 1999, this man was probably in his 30s or 40s. Tika's mother has been quoted as saying that Tika is frozen in memory as a smiling, joyful toddler, a feisty girl. If you have any information on the disappearance of Tika Lewis, please contact the Tacoma Cold Case Unit. The link will be posted in our show notes. For our next disappearance, we're heading to Idaho. Stephanie Crane was born on September 28, 1984. She had three younger sisters, and she was described as a tomboy. She loved hunting and fishing with her dad. She was also part of a youth bowling league. On October 11, 1993, Stephanie's mother gave her some money for a snack and dropped her off at the Chalice Bowling Alley. Stephanie went bowling with her friends and left around 4:45 p.m. Stephanie was last seen walking on Highway 93 toward Chalice High School around 6 p.m. The high school was across the street from the bowling alley, and Stephanie's home was actually really close to the bowling alley as well. According to Investigation Discovery, Stephanie told her friend that she was going to the high school field to grab her backpack, which she'd left there. The field was approximately 5 minutes from the bowling alley, and Stephanie's grandmother actually lived next door to the field. So all of this was relatively familiar space for Stephanie, and it was a space that she was often seen in. When Stephanie didn't come home by 8:15, her parents called police. Over 7,000 square miles in two counties were searched. They had searchers on foot, horseback, airplanes, and helicopter. They used dogs, and a boat crew searched the local canal, but unfortunately, nothing was found. Witnesses mentioned seeing a blue van as well as a yellow truck with red pinstripes in the area prior to Stephanie's disappearance. Over 300 volunteers helped police search for Stephanie. Police from Custer County Sheriff's Office, the FBI, and the Idaho State Police were all involved in Stephanie's case. There's been at least one named potential suspect in this case, and his name was Keith Mark Hescock. At the time of the disappearance, he lived in Idaho Falls, and on the day that Stephanie disappeared, he was actually hunting near Chalice, driving a yellow truck. Again, witnesses say they saw a yellow truck near the bowling alley where Stephanie was last seen. And this wasn't Hescock's first person of interest in a disappearance. He was also investigated in the disappearance of 20-year-old Amber Hoops, who went missing in Idaho Falls on September 14, 2001. Hescock was friends with a relative of Amber's, and unfortunately, Amber has never been found. And if that weren't enough, Hescock was also suspected of kidnapping a 14-year-old girl outside her home on June 5, 2002. Hescock worked for the girl's grandparents, and he chained her to a bed in his house, but thankfully, she was able to use a fire extinguisher to break the lock and escape while he was at work. Hescock led police on a 40-mile high-speed chase, which ended on a dead-end road in the mountains. Hescock shot and killed a police dog and shot a police officer before committing suicide. And unfortunately, police couldn't interrogate Hescock about Stephanie or Amber, so they have no way of connecting him to either of their cases. There was another suspect who was only identified as a quote-unquote drifter. Police tracked him down and found that he had been arrested for a sex crime with a minor. He was given a polygraph and was deemed extremely deceptive. Police also later found ropes containing human hair fibers in his, quote, underground dwelling, end quote. Unfortunately, even with all this, there wasn't sufficient evidence to prove that he had any connection to Stephanie Crane. If you have any information on the disappearance of Stephanie Crane, please call the Custer County Sheriff's Office at 208-879-2232 or call the Custer County Sheriff's tip line at 208-879-5372. The last case we're going to cover today is Sophia Juarez. Sophia Juarez was just 4 years old when she went missing on the day before her fifth birthday. On February 4th, 2003, Sophia had spent most of the day playing with her Barbies. At around 8 p.m., Sophia's grandma's boyfriend, Jose Torres, said that he was going to a local convenience store for a few things. Sophia asked her mother, Maria, if she could go with him. Maria agreed and gave her a dollar to buy a treat. Sophia and Maria had been living with Sophia's grandma, Ignacia, for about 2 years in Kennewick, Washington. They also lived with six of Sophia's aunts and uncles, as well as Jose. It was an incredibly close family, and they were all in one house. Unfortunately, Jose didn't realize that Sophia was going to come with him, and so he left without her. By the time Sophia got outside, Jose was pulling out of the driveway and headed off. Police believe that Sophia decided to either meet Jose at the store or walk to the store. It was only about 5 blocks away. Everyone in the family was completely unaware that Jose had left without Sophia. They assumed that the two had left together. But when Jose returned about 45 minutes later, that's when the family realized that Sophia was missing. They immediately began searching the neighborhood, but when they couldn't find Sophia, they called police. Sophia's case was treated as a serious missing persons case from the very beginning. The temperatures outside were below freezing, and Sophia didn't have a coat. Police went door to door on the route from Sophia's house to the store, looking for anyone who might have been a witness. Sophia's case was actually the first use of the Amber Alert system in Washington state. But unfortunately, after 36 hours, the Amber Alert was called off. Police questioned Jose Torres, who voluntarily took a polygraph and passed. He was eliminated as a suspect. Sophia's dad had never been involved in her life, but police tracked down Andreas Abregan and interviewed him. He told police that he'd never met his daughter Sophia and agreed to take a polygraph test. He passed and was also eliminated as a suspect. Eventually, all of Sophia's immediate family were cleared or ruled out. Police also questioned a registered sex offender living in the area. This man had access to a van, which police searched and searched his home, but they didn't find anything. This man was ruled out after he passed a polygraph test. There was nothing linking him to Sophia. Police interviewed over 1,200 people and had 200 tips that were all dead ends. One theory that Maria investigated was that a relative had abducted Sophia and took her to Mexico. So Maria and Ignacia went to Mexico looking for Sophia, but there was no evidence that Sophia had been taken there. Maria eventually moved to California in 2007. She eventually got married and had a son. Unfortunately, she died at the age of 26 after medical procedure complications. Sadly, she died without ever knowing what happened to her daughter, Sophia. There have been two big updates in this case as of June 2021. The first is that police released a tip that had been provided to them back in 2003. At that time, a credible witness had come forward saying that he saw Sophia being kidnapped by a boy between the ages of 11 and 14. This witness told police that the boy took Sophia by the hand and brought her to a van that was parked on the street. Sophia was crying, but the boy was laughing. Police couldn't confirm whether the boy was working alone or with someone else. The van was described as either light blue or gray, with no side windows, and was either a 1970s or early 1980s model. Police said they kept this tip confidential so that they could track the person down. Unfortunately, they never had any success tracking down the little boy, so that's why they decided to release this information in June of 2021. They described the little boy as Hispanic, with light complexion, chubby with a baby face, and short, dark, wavy hair. The second big update that came was a TikTok video. This TikTok video showed a 23-year-old woman in Culiacan, which many thought looked like a grown-up Sophia. The woman in the TikTok video claimed that she was being held against her will and she was trying to be reunited with her family. Police were working to confirm her identity through a DNA sample, but as of August 23, 2021, police were able to track down the female's family, who told them that she was in rehab. They're hoping to have a video chat with her soon and obtain her DNA for a sample comparison. And unfortunately, those are all the updates that have been provided in Sophia's case. There have been no real leads since her disappearance. Police are hoping that they can find this little boy who would be in his mid-30s to early 40s at this time, and there's a $10,000 reward being offered. If you have any information on the disappearance of Sophia Juarez or the suspect that police are looking for, please contact the Kennewick Police Department. We will link the information in our show notes. Thank you for tuning in to this important episode on missing children in the Pacific Northwest. Again, if you have any information on any of the cases covered today, please check our show notes for the links to all of the law enforcement contacts and websites that you can go to provide your tips. Thank you again for listening. Please join us for the next two episodes in our series, which cover missing persons from Idaho and British Columbia, followed by Oregon and Washington. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Please subscribe and leave a review if you like the show. You can email case suggestions or comments to truecrimecatlawyer@gmail.com. The links for our social media pages are included in the show notes. You can find our discussion group on Facebook by searching for True Crime Cat Lawyer in the group section. And if you want more content, head over to Patreon to join one of our available tiers. You can get monthly mini and bonus episodes, as well as early access to our main episodes. Finally, if you're interested in learning more about my co-host, you can check out her Instagram at WinstonTheCatPDX. Thanks again for listening and stay tuned for our next episode.